refugees and migrants trying to cross a narrow channel here.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
It's clear that the risk of drowning at sea is not enough to deter, especially refugees who fled.
So far this year, more than 380,000 souls have undertaken the treacherous crossing of the Mediterranean into Europe, of whom some 2,800 have died en route. Hundreds of thousands more have traveled by air or trekked on foot. The exodus is testing the resources and the political will of the European Union, where humanitarian impulses compete against a stagnant economy and large pockets of Islamophobia. The crisis is also playing out in the language used to describe it.
Breaking news we're covering on the migrant crisis in Europe. So much human drama.
This exploding migrant crisis. Thousands of people are trying to escape war.
Europe's growing migrant crisis is playing out in Hungary. Thousands of desperate migrants are pushing and shoving their way into...
Perhaps taking their cues from politicians, in describing those seeking security in the West, media have favored the word migrant. The term isn't strictly inaccurate, comprising as it does both those looking for refuge from war or oppression and those simply trying to improve their economic lot. But it also isn't necessarily neutral. Note the contempt in this statement by France's President François Hollande.
We must differentiate between refugees and migrants. Migrants who are coming for other reasons, such as escaping poverty in their countries, cannot be welcomed under this regime.
And he's a socialist. The loading of language is particularly problematic at the moment because, in fact, the vast majority in the current influx are not purely economic migrants, but refugees in the purest sense. More than 70% of those who've made the sea crossing are from Syria, Afghanistan, Eritrea, and Somalia, desperate to flee the horrors of civil war and oppressive regimes.
We are not searching for food or shelter or such thing. We are here for safe, just we want to live.
Some say it's wrong to make the refugee-migrant distinction, arguing that it implicitly creates a hierarchy of need. As Professor Jorgen Carling of the Peace Research Institute Oslo wrote, quote, "When people drown at sea or suffocate in lorries, our first question should not be so, which kind were they, refugees or migrants? But when walls are built and police deployed and opportunistic politicians are playing for votes, semantic distinctions can be a matter of life and death." Many news organizations, including AP, BBC, NPR, The New York Times, and The Washington Post, have reported on this linguistic debate. Notably, one outlet, Al Jazeera English, has taken an official position to abandon the word migrant in favor of refugee. Barry Malone is online editor for Al Jazeera English, and he wrote about the thinking behind the editorial staff's decision.
We felt that the word had shifted, that it had evolved away from its dictionary definition in the Mediterranean context, and that it had started to become something of a political tool and also a pejorative. And then there are governments who are insistent on speaking about a migrant crisis and very keen to avoid the word refugee because, of course, they have different legal obligations when it comes to refugees than when it comes to so-called economic migrants.
Specifically, you can't turn refugees away. According to international law, going back to 1951, you can build walls to keep migrants away.
If migrants or, you know, so-called economic migrants show up without legal papers, then yes, countries can turn them away. And they simply can't do that with refugees. And so you can see a clear political reason why some governments don't want to say the word refugee. And I think one of the key tenets of journalism is that we should never blindly accept a terminology that those in power would prefer us to use. You know, we should always question that terminology, investigate it, and if necessary, challenge it. And this time, when we looked at the figures, we just thought it was necessary to challenge it.
It's an interesting journalistic problem because I think our instincts are to choose the right word by dictionary definition. But we're not operating in a vacuum, and if the decision to default to the pure, accurate dictionary definition, as you say, is a de facto political decision, reading the dictionary turns a journalist into a political actor. It's a tough circle to square.
One of the criticisms that I've seen made of us is that we have politicized these terms by refusing to use the term migrant, that we are somehow making a political move. And, you know, I fundamentally disagree with that. Our move was not political. It was rooted in a desire for accuracy. And to me, therefore, it was completely journalistic.
Now, there is another solution that has been proffered, and that is to simply say migrants and refugees, to use both to achieve specificity that way.
To be honest, I don't think it's a bad solution. I thought it was a very good contribution to the debate from UNHCR, who, after all, are the people who are at the coalface of this problem, actually there on the shores of Europe dealing with it. But having said that, we don't want to create a hierarchy of people who are crossing the Mediterranean Sea with this decision. This was not about us trying to say refugees are important and forget about the so-called economic migrants. They also deserve respect, and they also deserve all of the legal protections that are available to them. But of course, the fact is that those legal protections, as you've said earlier, are different. One criticism that's been made of us is that we may contribute to that debate by stopping using the word instead of trying to reclaim it. I thought that was valid. And, you know, if the word could be reclaimed, then we may well go back to using it because, you know, our style guide is very much a living thing and we have these discussions about terminology every day.
And I suppose if your overcrowded boat off the coast of Bodrum, Turkey, capsizes and you're drowned, it really doesn't matter what Al Jazeera calls you.
Absolutely. You could definitely make an argument, and I think a very compelling one, to say talking about the word is a sideshow. You know, we're trying very hard at this network, and we're not alone in it. But to tell the human story, you know, to go and speak to the people and find out how they've gotten into this situation, where they've come from, what has pushed them from their homes. But, you know, words do have power as well, and journalists do wield power in the way that they use those words. And we have a tremendous power as media organizations to shape these conversations. And although it's a semantic argument, trying to describe more accurately the horrible situation that most of these people have found themselves in is an attempt to kind of reveal their humanity more so that people can identify with them.
Barry, many thanks.
Thanks, Bob. Nice talking to you.
Barry Malone is the online editor for Al Jazeera English. Word choice is by no means the only way the media have skewed our understanding of the current humanitarian crisis. Repeated focus on some aspects of the human displacement at the expense of others, and some wrong basic assumptions underlying reporting, have perpetuated a variety of myths and misunderstandings. Doug Saunders, international affairs columnist for Canada's The Globe and Mail, says that false narratives about migration to Europe not only cloud our understanding, they also have dangerous implications for asylum seekers themselves. One major myth, that the West is bearing the brunt of the current crisis.
There's, I think, an image that Europe is being flooded. These countries, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, are emptying themselves of people and that they're all coming to the West.
A stream of migrants from the Middle East flooding into the European nations that are struggling to keep up with the influx.
This human tide of desperation is now cresting across the borders of Europe.
In fact, the proportion who are looking to go to Europe or North America are minuscule. The vast majority of people forced to leave their homes by the Syrian conflict that's been going on since 2011 are displaced within Syria and will never leave Syria. More than twice the number of people who are refugees are the people who are so-called internally displaced persons. And of the 4 million or so people who do have to leave the country, almost all of them are just outside the borders of Syria, in absolutely huge camps of hundreds of thousands of people in Turkey, in Jordan, in Lebanon. Then you have a tiny group, fewer than 10% of the total population, who do seek international refuge. Those don't tend to be the people who were in the camps. It's not as if the hundreds of thousands of people in the refugee camps are then getting on boats across the Mediterranean. It tends to be a very different group of people who have the economic means to pay $3,000 per person to make the boat or foot crossing. It's in the hundreds of thousands. It is one of the largest groups of international refugees that we've seen in recent decades. But generally speaking, the West is only taking a tiny, tiny sample. It's not as if the entire population of Syria is trying to move to the West.
Nor is it necessarily that once finding refuge, either in Turkey or in Jordan or in Germany, that all of these people intend to stay there indefinitely.
I'm really curious to see how this migrant picture changes the long-term employment situation in many of these countries.
And Merkel said just a few days ago, this will change Germany permanently.
Refugees, and particularly these refugees, don't generally tend to become permanent immigrants. A very large plurality and probably majority of these people are going to return to Syria. They tend to be people who are not fleeing poverty. They're fleeing a disruption of their lives caused by war. They have property. They often have small businesses and investments and opportunities back in the region. Assuming the war does not go on for decades and decades and decades, a large proportion will return. Of the 2.2 million Bosnians who fled their country during that conflict in the 1990s, by some measures, all but about 300,000 ended up returning. So we have to keep in mind that it's an emergency crisis, probably temporary. Remember, the wars in Serbia and Croatia and Bosnia and Kosovo seemed to be interminable as well, and it did eventually end up dying down and people moved back. So people prefer to move back and forth when they have the opportunity. They only become permanent when those opportunities to move back and forth are blocked.
We have come away with the notion that this exodus is taking place largely at sea.
This is the extraordinary scene every morning, boat after boat of migrants and refugees coming ashore. These ones having rowed all the way from Turkey.
This is one of three boats, and as you can see, this is absolutely crammed. It's meant to hold 15 people. There must be 40 on this one.
It's not just happening at sea, and there are periods when there are more people coming over by means other than sea. In 2015, we have the explosion of this foot route across the Western Balkans and across Greece and Hungary and so on, a couple different foot routes, which also involve smugglers, which at least during some months of this year have exceeded all the boat routes combined in numbers. And when you talk to officials in countries like Germany, they say that the people arriving by foot across the Balkans are a bigger concern for them now than the people coming by boat from Libya across to the islands off of Italy.
Some countries, notably the reactionary government of Hungary, have put every impediment in place that they can, including walls, to keep migrants from settling there or even passing through on their way to Western Europe.
Hungary is still erecting a fence along its border and has vowed to take tougher measures by mid-September.
So you have people like David Cameron saying, we'll send the economic migrants back home.
Now we have countries like Macedonia putting up walls, Hungary putting up walls to keep them out.
Does that reduce the overall flow of refugees?
We've generally seen that attempts to physically block or turn back immigrants have not reduced the numbers. They've increased the danger. The most egregious example of that we saw was on the Mediterranean boat crossing route, where until 2014, the European Union had had a program run by the Italian government called Mare Nostrum, which was designed to rescue people on these dangerous boats. And rescue by nature, it meant taking them to the shores of Europe and processing them. And this became controversial. And they said, instead of rescuing them and bringing them to Europe, let's try to send them back. What ended up happening was that the number of migrants crossing didn't decrease. In fact, you actually saw a slight increase in the number of people crossing this way. But what did increase was the number of people dying at sea, which in fact increased 50-fold. These are people who put a big family investment into this or taking a big risk, and simply trying to physically block them at the end of the journey is not only probably not going to work, but could end up costing a lot of lives. Hungary is particularly being unfriendly about this. And it's a particularly dark irony, given that the first big wave of non-Western refugees in the post-war period were the Hungarians. And many Western countries like the United States and Canada settled hundreds of thousands of people fleeing Hungary as refugees. And that memory has almost been lost by the current government of Hungary.
As you've looked at the coverage to date, is there any particular repeated error that just simply makes you wince?
It's the notion that we're going to be flooded by these people and that they're going to overwhelm us. We've seen so many groups come into the West before who have been controversial. We've said they're not going to assimilate, that we can't handle them, and we've handled them just fine. The Vietnamese, many people felt that either they were going to contain communist insurgents or that they were by nature unassimilable. Nevertheless, they settled fine. The refugees from Bosnia and Kosovo in the 1990s They were Muslim. They were from what seemed to be an alien civilization to many people. They were settled quickly, and they became an uncontroversial group of people in the cities and regions where they settled. But still, we seem to be returning in many countries and many people's voices to a view that we thought had died out, which is that refugees are a threat, that they're going to contain dangerous people.
There are fears that jihadists could be hidden among the migrants.
How many boat people and others who seem to be economically motivated are actually terrorists?
The Prime Minister of Hungary saying there's a clear link between migrants heading to Europe and the rising terror threat there.
I mean, keep in mind the Syrians are mostly fleeing the group known as Islamic State or ISIS. Yet still, we see headlines that they're going to contain large numbers of terrorists and extremists and all this sort of thing. Remember, this is a group of people whose numbers are dwarfed by our general immigration numbers anyway, and who are not going to last forever. So we need to step back and say, okay, we've done this before. It's worked out fine. This is not going to be permanent. It's not going to be overwhelming. Let's help these people and let them get back on their feet. They can benefit our countries, we can help theirs, and it'll be over at a certain point.
Doug, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Doug Saunders is international affairs columnist for Canada's The Globe and Mail and author of the book Arrival City, which examines migrant neighborhoods in 20 places around the world. Coming up, more myth-busting, this time about migration on this side of the Atlantic. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. We just heard what the conversation about the mass movement of people sounds like in Europe. In the U.S., the politicized conversation about immigration sounds a little different. Here's GOP frontrunner Donald Trump telling NBC's Chuck Todd about his plan to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants and their U.S.-born kids.
So you're going to split up families?
Chuck.
You're going to deport children?
Chuck, no. We're going to keep the families together. We have to keep the families together.
But you're going to keep them together out?
But they have to go.
What if they have no place to go?
We will work with them. They have to go. Chuck, we either have a country or we don't have a country.
Well, obviously we have an individual who doesn't have an understanding of history. In particular, the great repatriations of the 1930s.
Francisco Balderrama is co-author of Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s, about a mostly forgotten chapter of U.S. history. During the stress of the Great Depression, U.S. officials undertook a mass expulsion of Mexican immigrants and their American-born children in precisely the manner and for precisely the reasons now being championed by Trump.
Using the same language, people talked about the expulsion of Mexicans and frequently invoking the notion or the idea that we'll keep the families together. And by keeping the families together, obviously unconstitutionally deporting American citizens of Mexican descent who are American citizens by birth.
Well, I must say, if Donald Trump was clueless, so was I. You know, I know about the Trail of Tears. I know about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. I know about the refusal to accept Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany. But until a few days ago, I had never heard about this so-called repatriation of Mexicans and Mexican Americans in the midst of the Depression. Tell me first about its scale.
Well, we're talking about conservatively over 1 million Mexican nationals. About 60% of those were U.S. citizens, either because they were children or they were spouses of Mexican nationals during that moment. And we have it occurring throughout the United States, from the American Southwest to the Midwest to the Deep South, Pacific Northwest, also including Alaska. Especially in the winter of 1930-1931, the Hoover administration conducted very publicized raids. Here in Los Angeles, we had the infamous Placita raid in downtown Los Angeles. Businesses, U.S. Steel, Southern Pacific Railroad, Ford Motor Company, these companies sought to decline their workforce, by focusing on Mexicans and providing transportation for Mexicans to leave the country. At the same time, on the local level, the different counties, the different states, then took it into their own hands to round up individuals, frequently referring to that we're going to cut charities, we're going to cut relief by shipping Mexicans home.
That itself sounds awfully familiar. There is today, in 2015, a lot of rhetoric about the cost of supporting an immigrant population. Is it a direct parallel? This did all take place, of course, in the depths of the Great Depression.
Los Angeles had the largest Mexican concentration in the United States, and most of the Mexican population had been longtime residents of L.A. County, about 60% for quite a time, and were on welfare no more than a year or so. We found about 40% of them. In other words, Mexicans never constituted that much of the welfare population, and it also raised serious questions that even with their expulsion, would that have produced, to use the words of the 1930s, that many jobs for Americans?
You made reference to the raid at La Placita in 1931 in downtown L.A. Tell me about it. Was it an atrocity? Was it like the raid on Stonewall in Greenwich Village in the 60s? Was it Kristallnacht? What was it?
I think it's more of a declaration of the attitude of American society. By targeting this particular area, the historic core of the city, the Mexican population had been involved with the founding of the city and the development of the city. They're making a declaration here that Mexicans are not wanted, that Mexicans are not a part of the society. Rather, they are disposable labor. We use them in good economic times, and we get rid of them in bad economic times if we need to do that. And the Placita raid underscores that. And because Los Angeles had this great concentration, it becomes kind of the model. We don't call it deportation. We call it repatriation. We organize trains. That's the way we get rid of the Mexicans.
Your late co-author, Raymond Rodriguez, testified at a California State Senate hearing in 2003 about his personal history.
In many cases, families were split. That happened in our family. My dad left in 1936 when I was 10. I never saw my dad again.
How big a profile did this program have? Was the American public even aware that this was going on? Was it an issue? Was it a controversy? Was it a debate?
It's not so much a debate. It's rather an accepted idea. This is really what's best for them, to go to Mexico where they belong. There is in some of the documentation, every once in a while, some official remarking, well, these are U.S. citizens. Sometimes supervisors saying, it doesn't make any difference. They're all Mexicans. We want to keep the families together. So just proceed with their so-called repatriation. The federal government, as we go into the Roosevelt years and the New Dealers, they're pretty blind to this. Much like later on, they're blind to the placement of Japanese Americans in concentration camps.
Has this episode even shown up in textbooks?
Well, it has been a part of the teaching of Chicano history and Chicano studies. But in mainstream U.S. history courses, sometimes the only reference to Mexicans and Latinos is the obligatory reference to Cesar Chavez. But no understanding of this. There has been passage just last week of AB 146 here in the state of California that, if signed by the governor, encourages the teaching of unconstitutional deportation of the 1930s in California schools. The state of California in 2006 recognized it and offered an apology. That apology was memorialized with a monument right at the site of the Placita raid. That understanding of it, that knowledge of it, that teaching of it, I think is a good insurance policy in terms of not having this outrageous type of public policy implemented.
Francisco, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Francisco Balderrama is professor of history and Chicano studies at California State University, Los Angeles. He is the co-author, with the late Raymond Rodriguez, of Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s.
In America, we say you have the right to believe what you want as long as you're not harming others. So as long as you're not trying to limit the freedoms of other people, we believe in the right of freedom of self-expression, religious liberty, freedom of speech.
Louisiana governor and candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, Bobby Jindal, said it all.
Again, we believe in religious liberty, but that doesn't mean you can use your freedoms to undermine the freedoms of other people. Now,
speaking to Fox News Channel's Megyn Kelly, Jindal was articulating a central principle of American democracy. Your freedom of your own beliefs ends where my rights and secular laws begin. Yet that somehow has been a raging debate for a week.
We serve a living God who knows exactly where each and every one of us is at. Just keep on pressing. Don't let down. Because he is here. And he's worthy, he's worthy.
That was, of course, Rowan County, Kentucky Clerk of Courts and Christian martyr Kim Davis upon her release from jail. She'd been held for contempt of court for refusing, on religious grounds, to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. And Jindal believes that she was justly incarcerated for putting her personal belief ahead of her sworn duty to the Constitution. Oh, wait. No, he doesn't. He thinks Davis was persecuted for her devout Christianity.
Religious freedom is being able to live your life 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, according to your beliefs. There's no freedom of speech or freedom of association unless we have our religious freedom rights. This is an essential right in America.
Turns out Jindal espouses that secular law should prevail over fundamentalist Muslims.
We shouldn't tolerate those who want to come and try to impose some variant or some version of Sharia law.
But not against fundamentalist Protestants. And in that, he is not alone. Texas Senator and Republican presidential hopeful Ted Cruz.
For the first time, we're seeing a Christian woman thrown in jail for standing up for her faith. I'll tell you, I stand with Kim Davis unequivocally. I stand with her and anyone else that the government is trying to persecute for standing up for their faith.
Former Pennsylvania Senator and Republican presidential hopeful Rick Santorum.
What Kim Davis did, in my opinion, was heroic, and she suffered the consequences.
And former Arkansas Governor and Republican presidential hopeful Mike Huckabee.
We are under an obligation to obey God and the law, and if necessary, to defy an institution that is out of control.
The Supreme Court, he means. That is, the institution charged by the Constitution to guarantee what John Adams called a government of laws, not of men. All these candidates who have sworn on the Bible to uphold the Constitution seem to have a flimsy grasp of what the blueprint for our democracy actually provides. Namely, the Establishment Clause, which separates church and state, the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the law, and, as Fox News host Greg Jarrett points out,
Article 3, Section 2, Sharon, of the Constitution gives the Supreme Court constitutional authority to decide constitutional issues.
Yes, in the hubbub over the non-issuance of marriage licenses to those legally entitled to them, the GOP right actually questioned the judiciary's authority to interpret the law. Mike Huckabee.
It's the Supreme Court, and it certainly is not the supreme being. It cannot overrule the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God.
And once again, Ted Cruz.
Who in their right mind would design a system where every major public policy issue of the day is decided not by the people, not by the Constitution, not by elected representatives, but by nine elite lawyers in Washington, D.C. As Justice Scalia.
Senator, I'm delighted to be able to answer that question for you. Who designed the system? Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin. You know, those crackpots. Seriously, there ought to be a law. Coming coming up, the museumification of September 11th. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Brooke is in Vienna on assignment. More on that next week. But this week, we felt it appropriate to revisit a piece she reported in May 2014, on the day the 9/11 Museum first opened.
If journalism is the first draft of history, museumification probably is the last. So OTM producer Meera Sharma and I went down to mark that moment for 9/11, on the opening day of the museum in its name, built on the footprint of the Twin Towers. You're hearing one of two huge fountains, each one roughly the size of a tower. The water flows down from long straight walls across a black square into a smaller square with no visible bottom. Surrounding the fountain is a black granite platform where the names of the dead are inscribed, arranged not alphabetically or chronologically, but in accordance with something called meaningful adjacency. Essentially, the friendships and personal relationships were mapped, and then an algorithm linked together the names. It means that someone who helped a stranger, but they both died, will be next to each other on the wall. Inside, you first encounter the sight and sound of those who saw 9/11 from afar, an estimated one-third of humanity.
I'll never forget where I was.
I was in a coffee shop in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Watching my grandchild. I was driving to work at 5:45 in the morning.
First thing I thought of was my parents. I wanted to talk to the people that I love the most. So I started to call my friends.
Go to the end of the hall, the broad swath of blue tiles. And in the midst of those tiles is the saying in raised stone, a quote from Virgil, "No day shall erase you from the memory of time."
My dad, Michael Joseph Lindsay.
Then people reciting the names of those they personally lost.
My friend, Dan Wiswold.
My father, Barry H.
Flick. Our son, John Edward Bulaga Jr.
My cousin, Alfredo Gomez.
Someone you know?
There are walls of glossy 8x10s of the dead and a database. Is there something helpful about looking up your cousin on this database?
Well, I just told my cousin's wife that we were coming here, so I told her that I would, if I could find anything. And I just happened to walk in and the picture was right there.
Is it strange that someone you know is going to be enshrined in a museum for as long as this museum exists?
Yeah. It brings it more to home, probably. You know,
more
knowing.
To home.
Well, because I grew up in Yonkers. You know, we could see the smoke down the Metro North train station after. So that was home. And I had a lot of cousins that worked down here. And they did survive. But knowing that my cousin's cousin didn't, you know, it's hard.
I just wonder how weird it must be to have living history.
When you were living. Yeah, no, it's true. Everything we're seeing here, you know, I saw it live on TV, you know, so it's strange.
Do you think you'll come back?
I might, yeah, I might. You know, come back with other family members or whatnot, but yeah.
So it's working for you.
Yeah, they did a good job, and it came out. It's beautiful, I think.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Can I ask your name?
Patty Ann.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
You don't want to, on this first day of this museum, approach people who've experienced a devastating loss. On the other hand, of course I do. I'm a radio reporter. This wall of pictures was created with resources contributed by family members and friends of those killed in the attack. Wow. wedding pictures. Jill Maher Campbell looks beautiful. Charles Armendez is a fireman. He looks really young. Patricia Ann Cimaroli Massari is wearing a tiara. She looks like she won a beauty pageant. Across the hall, there's a balcony, and down the stairs, the concrete stuff of toppled temples and soaring blades of twisted metal. Mira, this is the most stunning piece of bent metal that I've ever laid eyes on.
Almost like arms reaching.
Mm-hmm.
Limbs kind of twisted.
Yeah.
It's incredibly majestic, actually.
It says that it's the section of the steel facade, North Tower, floors 93 to 96.
The underbelly of the aircraft actually mangled this section of wall. There's something so oddly kind of sculptural about everything. Curves and bent metal and just the weight of it.
This looks like something John Chamberlain might have made. A lot of this stuff does. Crushed metal. A confusion of chaos and intention. You know, abstract expressionism. Spontaneous and yet designed to evoke feelings in others. This whole event was designed to evoke feelings in others. Does this museum mean that the terrorists lost or won? You know, it's a stupid question anyway. I hate that question. The World Trade Center by the numbers. Approximately 50,000 people worked in it. Each tower had 110 floors. Each floor was an acre in size. On windy days, each tower would sway 12 inches side to side. There were 198 elevators in the Twin Towers and 15 miles of elevator shafts. On a clear day, you could see 45 miles in each direction from the observation deck. There's a place where they keep the toughest stuff, not the world's witnesses, nor even the bereaved, but the perspective of those on the ground in the moment.
What we did was we made a little alcove, and we made a warning saying that this is what's in here. If you want to come in, go ahead. We also suggest not to bring kids in here, so it's not completely displayed. We give warning about it. And it is a little difficult to find, so I'll walk you over there as well.
Copy that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Go through a revolving door.
Building 1 and Building 2. Roger, evacuate all buildings in the complex. You copy? All buildings in the complex.
Fire department. They're coming through the building, sir. I got almost every fireman in the city coming to help you. I understand. Just sit tight. The best we got, we'll get to you as soon as we can.
Sensory assault. You have the text, the images, the audio playing. It's like being inside this kind of horror vortex or something.
My first thought was that I'm dead. And then I started to smell smoke. I felt above my head. There was a slab of concrete that had fallen at an angle. And at that point, I heard someone behind me say, "Don't leave me." He grabbed my ankle, he moved behind me, and I just started digging.
The next thing I remember was just a bright, bright light. And somebody said, "If you see the light, come to the light." I'm hearing noises, and I'm hearing, "Help me," and it just sounds surreal, like I'm in a dream or something.
I just now started picking people up and saying, "Wait here, I'm going to step out and look up, and when I tell you to go, you need to go like you've never gone before."
20 minutes later, I saw a little peephole of light. I was able to make a small hole. So I said to the man behind me, "I'll squeeze you through the hole." I pushed him up. I squeezed myself through the rebar. I scraped my body down completely. We were on a pile of rubble. It was red hot. My shoes began to melt into the girder as I was standing there. All around me was like being in a blizzard. It was just paper, gray smoke, everything swirling.
As we're going along, you're like kind of picking up people that are wandering. People are disoriented because nothing looks the way it did an hour ago. The whole area was gray. Even when you looked up, all you saw was gray.
Cece Lyles is a flight attendant. She leaves a message for her husband.
Baby, you have to listen to me carefully. I'm on a plane that's been hijacked. I'm on the plane. I'm calling from the plane. I want to tell you I love you. Please tell my children that I love them very much. And I'm so sorry. I don't know what to say. There's three guys that hijacked the plane. I'm trying to be calm. We're turned around. And I've heard that there's planes that have been flown into the World Trade Center. I hope to be able to see your face again, baby. I love you. Bye.
There's an alcove with photos of those who chose to jump rather than burn, both at the moment of decision and then plummeting, floating. There's also quotes from those who watched, like James Gilroy. She had a business suit on. Her hair was all askew. This woman stood there for what seemed like minutes, and then she held down her skirt and stepped off the ledge. I thought, how human, how modest to hold down her skirt before she jumped. I couldn't look anymore.
Currently, we have seven patients, and more patients are coming to us. Parkway and West Broadway.
Though the visitors certainly were solemn, there were no tears. Maybe after more than a decade of anniversaries, the national mantle of mourning no longer suits the time. After all, the city and the nation have seen many catastrophes. This was a huge one, but perhaps more important, it was our catastrophe. 50 years from now, it will be a catastrophe. And it's in places like these that future generations will experience it. What that experience will be like for them, we can't possibly know.
I'm Jake Barton, principal and founder of Local Projects. We're the media designer and production firm for the 9/11 Memorial Museum.
What was the hardest thing?
The hardest thing about the project was trying to balance between the emotional safety of the visitors, a young adult, a 15-year-old who knows literally nothing about this day, and on the other side, first responders or people who ran out of the burning buildings for their lives. And so trying to make an authentic and frankly meaningful experience for both audiences was an incredible challenge.
When you walk in, you hear this montage of voices, people who experienced it from a distance. But when you go through the revolving doors, you are then put in the path of the direct experience of the people on the site at that moment.
We gathered voices from all around the world through the internet, through phone, through a story booth that we had here on site. And it brings us back onto our own memories. When you go into the historic exhibition, you are literally placed into that moment. And it, frankly, is a moment of confusion and of revelation. You hear some people repeating misinformation, claiming on the news that this is just a small Cessna plane. It's clearly an accident. We actually place people inside of that moment of revelation to remind people that at that moment, 9/11 wasn't possible until it happened.
The museum's role is to create an experience for a generation that has no contact with it, like the Lincoln Memorial. Mm-hmm. How do you go about imagining how that might be experienced in 50 years?
I think both the memorial and certainly the museum have a very interesting relationship with time. 9/11, it's not history, right? Because it's still unfolding and its effects are literally being played out in headlines today, whether it's about Guantanamo, the Middle East, personal security and freedom, to all of these ways in which the post-9/11 world is continuing to evolve and change. And yet, it's definitely not current events. It's somewhere in between. And so the museum's job, I think, is both to preserve the memories, to tell the full story, but frankly, to do what it can to play a productive role within all of the conversations that are literally defining this post-9/11 world.
The Hall of History doesn't tell us about what was going on in Afghanistan in the 80s and doesn't talk about America's role in frequently over the decades supporting unpopular leaders in the region and generating hostility thereby.
So it's a big museum. There's a lot in it. There's actually really strong overt references to the history of the Middle East, to the rise of the radical fringe that led to Al-Qaeda, including America's role within the Middle East and certainly within the...
I'm just appalled that I seem to have strode right by that section. There are certain things that you really can't avoid passing through.
No question.
You know, this sort of historical part, I guess it was a decision not to make it an obligatory walkthrough.
Yes, definitely, definitely. We opted for a museum experience where there are different levels of disclosure. And so we don't necessarily have a children's exhibit, but we do have a general interstitial space, which is actually the majority of the museum, that is really absent of the toughest parts of the story. It has a crushed fire truck, and it has pictures of the towers there and gone. It has missing posters. It has the last column. But you have to actually enter through those revolving doors into the historic exhibition to get the story of the day and the day before and the aftermath. And then even within there, there are different alcoves that tell even tougher parts of the stories. From inside the towers, from inside of Flight 93, it's essentially allowing people to, again, make the choice to go in and to be confronted with the most difficult material inside the museum.
So much of this, I mean, I am a big art museum goer.
Sure.
And I would see a Chamberlain sculpture and,
yep.
And a Richard Serra structure and things that look like religious iconography.
Yep.
Did any of that strike you?
Yeah, there was a ton of conversation during the planning and design process about how to distinctly actually avoid aestheticizing different parts of this experience, because the artifacts themselves are so powerful, it's just not appropriate to try and put something on top of them.
Our natural tendency to anthropomorphize makes you see arms reaching up to heaven or
yes.
twisted limbs. There's a lot of pain that's evoked by those inanimate objects, even if we saw them entirely absent of 9/11 as a context.
No question. I think the context, though, because you're inside of essentially the largest artifact, the void that the museum fills, the original infrastructure that held the towers, and you're on the site, this hallowed ground, it charges the atmosphere and the mind so that when you see the fire truck that we have inside the historic exhibition, one part of it that you encounter is completely pristine, it's almost untouched, and then when you turn a corner, you see the front, which is completely charred, completely destroyed. We couldn't help but notice that's essentially a metaphor for the day. You turned left, you lived, you turned right, you perished. And that was simply the fact of that day, just based on how the towers went down and on the lives that were lost.
A word about that controversial gift shop. It had lots of books, ranging from collections of photos to personal recollections to the 9/11 report to histories like the looming tower. There was an NYPD jacket for your dog. In fact, there were a lot of tributes to search and rescue dogs. There were I Love New York More Than Ever mugs, images of that survivor tree found living in the rubble on mugs and t-shirts. There was a sweatshirt with the saying, "In darkness we shine the brightest." Seems a delicate notion for a hoodie, but we were offended by none of it. The reality is, 9/11 was commodified long ago. Now it lives in a museum, and people may want a little something to remember it by.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Alex Friedland, and our show was edited this week by executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer was Joe Plord. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.